Support for Sound Effect comes from WSECU. Local to Washington, WSECU is a credit union founded in public service. Today, WSECU serves more than 260,000 members. More information is available at wsecu.org. WSECU, serving Washington since 1957.
I grew up in Bellevue. I went to Bellevue Christian. My dad was a Boeing engineer. My mom's a school teacher. There was a phase in the late 80s and 90s where they were really religious. It was the era of evangelical churches and just really crazy right-wing politics. And my parents were flirting with that at that point. They sent me to a school that had no dancing. There was no football team. It was in Medina.
Hey, I'm Gabriel Spitzer. This is Sound Effect, and I'm talking to Mary McIntyre about a formative period in her life.
From my view, it was very safe. It was very conservative. Rocking the boat was not a great thing. I would say most of us were virgins when we graduated from high school. You know, there's a lot of careful attention paid to our chastity and to our to staying in the faith. My sister and I, we didn't fit into that mold well. I was looking for something else.
Did you rebel? I mean, were there times when you just completely went the other direction?
It took me a while. I went to a rich kid school in Westmont, called Westmont in Santa Barbara, for a semester before realizing that, well, I think the school as well realized that I needed to be on academic probation. And I was just like, what am I doing? And there was some kids downtown in Santa Barbara that were rainbow gathering kids. So the rainbow gathering, it's started in the 70s, and it was a bunch of Vietnam vets and a bunch of hippies. Everyone comes in, and it's a community based on individual kitchens and a center circle. And it just grows and grows and grows. It's a bit like the Burning Man idea, except for it's definitely on living and learning about survival. I remember walking three of them down to the train station, and where the trains get really slow there, and having them, they were hopping a train to go to Arizona, and I was going back to Westmont. And I thought, I want to get on that train with them.
Yeah. So what'd you do?
So I quit school and I joined the Rainbow Family.
Today on Sound Effect, it's stories of my other family, the families we choose or who choose us, and how those connections shape who we are. Mary McIntyre did join up with the Rainbow Family, to the consternation of her birth family in Bellevue, and she'd go on to discover how her different families nurtured different parts of her. She told me how the person she grew into later in life was at least partly the product of her youthful wanderings.
My first rainbow gathering was in Prineville, Oregon, and I hitchhiked there, and I think I had $200, and I was going to make it last for emergencies. So I was just going on nothing, and I had a sleeping bag and a tent, and I took off, and my dad and mom were just thought I was crazy.
Did the way you dress change, the way that you kind of present yourself?
Oh, completely. Yeah. I did the full, I was young, you know, and impressionable, and I did the full, I let my hair go wild and made my own clothes, which I still do.
So you went to your first gathering, and what was the experience like?
It was great. It was perfect for that age. I was there for 2 months, and then I was able to find a ride with the Wrecking Crew, as it turns out.
The who?
The Wrecking Crew, which is, this was a crew. They had toured the dead for 30 years and sold tie-dyes and LSD on the dead lot. And they were a really, really rough crew. Fast Eddie was the leader. I was brought in with a boyfriend I had at the time named Dakota. They were homeless guys, a lot of them. Fast Eddie was brilliant and illiterate. They wore full tie-dyes and leather fringe items.
Did you feel like you belonged, and did you want to belong?
I really tried to belong. I had to lose so much of my etiquette that I was brought up with, growing up where everyone smells good and is very confined by social conventions and niceties. And I had to decide which ones I was going to keep and which ones I was going to discard. They did me no favors there. These were guys that on a pinch would eat out of a dumpster, were just perfectly happy sleeping in their boots and not changing clothes for 2 months, you know, that kind of thing. Like, I got used to that.
And how did you come down? Like, where were your boundaries?
I kind of settled for being kind of a lady, you know, like I took care of these guys and made sure that the older guys had beer in the morning and hide it from the younger guys so that to make sure that it was fair because they were very alcoholic. And I cleaned up. I would keep us from getting arrested when we pull into a small town, you know, stuff like that. It was a big job.
Wow. So you said inside you were still kind of a Bellevue girl. Do you think that they knew that?
Oh, absolutely. They thought it was hilarious. We were cooking dinner over a fire with a skillet. And it was, I think, probably something with beans in it. Everything had beans in it. And as everyone was eating, I went to clean the dishes and I scrubbed the out of a pan, a cast iron pan, a skillet, and was caught red-handed doing this deed of horror. By a man from the Tennessee commune. He was aghast. He said, "I can't believe what you're doing, what you've done. This is my family's skillet, and you've cleaned away its past." And everyone stood around horrified at what I had done. I was just cleaning up. And from Bellevue, I'd never even heard of a skillet before.
Well, how did it come to be that you guys parted ways?
I had broken up with this boy, Dakota, and I talked to my mom from a bar in North Carolina. And I said, "I'm having a really hard time. I just wanted to let you know where I'm at." And she said, "I'm going to buy you a ticket home." And I said, "No, don't do that." And she said, "I've already done it." And so I came home and ended up getting a job at the Blue Moon Tavern.
So was it disappointing in some ways or kind of a letdown when that sort of all wound down, came to a close?
No, it wasn't. It felt really good. I felt like I had accomplished something by surviving and getting all over the United States, hitchhiking, doing all these things that I was afraid to do. To this day, I still feel like it's my Armageddon skills, you know, like...
Wait, you're what?
My Armageddon skills, like... It's the idea that if everything goes to hell in this existence here, I can hit the road. I know how to do it. It's a skill.
So when you came back to the Northwest and you got the job at the Blue Moon, what did that world do for you?
Well, the Blue Moon is, especially at that point, was just about as rough as the Wrecking Crew. And I was allowed to be whoever I wanted there. And the clientele was really rough. Lots of homeless people, lots of dealers, lots of deadheads. And this was a crew that would go camping 2 weeks out of the year up in Roslyn. They did Christmas and Thanksgiving dinner together. Like
the staff?
The staff and the patrons, yeah.
Wow.
So it had some of that communal... scene. It created a scene for me to land softly back into this life of living in one place.
So you brought some of that life back to the place where you began. Do you feel
definitely.
Like you kind of brought your worlds together in some ways?
Yeah, it was absolutely the best place to land. And I was, by my estimation, unhirable coming back with my experience. But when I found this, I recognized its value. And that this connection to, oddly, over the years, to my other family, is that Gus, the owner, Gus Heltaler, ended up being a lot like a father to me. And he was the opposite of my father. Here's this man who has been an anarchist. He's been a biker. He's running this crazy establishment. He is very hands-off about discipline. He was the opposite of my father. I think my father walks on water, but they had very different ideas about what makes one an adult. And they have met several times, and I think they really get a good chuckle out of each other. And my father appreciates Gus and what he's added to my education.
Mary McIntyre still works at the Blue Moon, and she's co-owner of the Streamline Tavern in Seattle. You're tuned to Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today our theme is My Other Family. Lauren Davis and Ricky Garcia met when they were teenagers, about to launch into the world, working together at a preschool in Issaquah. Lauren was drawn to this young man.
And I had a huge crush on him, and everybody knew it.
Soon after that, she invited me to go hiking with her.
While Ricky really liked Lauren, he did not have romantic feelings for her because he's gay.
At the time, I wasn't out to anyone. And I invited my nephew and my niece to come along on our hike together and totally ruined her plans.
I was the first person he came out to. And at that point, I had already known for some time.
I do remember that I could not say the word gay. I remember Lauren actually called me that night, and she actually like forced me to say it. She forced me to tell her that I was actually gay, because I had such an issue with it. But yeah, that's how it happened.
And then Ricky and I became very close friends. I spent a ton of time with his family. He has a ton of nieces and nephews who were much younger at the time, and got to go to all their birthday parties, spend holidays with the family. We took trips together. We went down to California. We took his little nephew. We went all over the place in the summer together.
She constantly jokes about how like she adopted herself into my family. My family loves her, and so do I. I mean, Lauren was always just very caring, very giving, very genuine. Yeah, she's family. That's a good way to put it. Yeah.
When I graduated college, I had studied abroad in Ghana, and I was hell-bent on moving there after college, and I did. I got a Fulbright scholarship and studied there, and Ricky continued his studies back home. And he was the first in his family to go to a four-year school, and of course we kept in touch. But because I was in Ghana, I wasn't necessarily aware of the depth of what was happening.
It was one of those things where I knew I was feeling depressed. I was feeling really anxious. Most of the time, I wanted to escape all of that. And I just started to self-medicate and take whatever it took for me to escape reality. But I just became uber dependent on, in particular, alcohol. And then I slowly started to dabble in other things, such as like heroin. I mean, I was doing marijuana. I was popping a lot of pills. I went from it being manageable to just being completely uncontrollable. She came back, and I remember she was sitting in the room with me.
I remember he was wearing a Mexico jersey. His family had just come back from visiting Mexico, and he just broke down crying in my arms.
And I was drinking straight vodka from a water bottle. She had no idea.
The first time I ever had to call an ambulance for him was one morning when he urinated in the bed overnight and was just sort of convulsing and was salivating at his mouth and uncontrollably and crying uncontrollably, and I completely inconsolable, but I didn't know he was drunk. I mean, as silly and as strange as that sounds, at that point, this is just a few days into this 2-year journey, I didn't know he was drunk. I thought he was just having some emotional breakdown. He'd been, because he was hiding the alcohol, and his body movements were so off, and I called 911, and they asked me what was wrong, and I said, I don't know what's wrong, but I've never seen anybody in this condition before. They took him to the ambulance, said they were taking him to Harborview, and then we found out that his blood alcohol was over 400. And I was just, I mean, I had no idea. And that was really the beginning, and I learned a lot very quickly after that.
And that was the first time that I was admitted into a psych unit at Harborview. That was my first rodeo at Harborview.
That first hospitalization was terrifying. I remember the first time he was admitted there was at night, and was hugging him to leave, and he wouldn't let me go. And he said, you know, are you coming back in the morning? And I said, of course. And I was there 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. every single day. And I just would sit with him on the floor of his room, and he would shake, and somebody, I have no recollection if this person was a nurse or a medical assistant, but this person said to me, you know, Lauren, you really should just let Enrique be, because sometimes you just need to let them go crazy so we can see how sick they are. And I was haunted by that comment, because I felt like he was slipping through my grasp, and I knew so little about what was wrong with him or how to help. And what she said was terrifying to me. And I didn't take her advice. I sat beside him through that whole hospitalization, and he eventually stabilized and got into outpatient. And then again, I went back to Ghana and he relapsed. And this sort of pattern went on for the next 2 years of hospitalizations and brief stability and sobriety and relapse and on and on and on.
I felt ashamed of everything that I was doing. I felt ashamed of the way that I was feeling. I felt ashamed of who I had become at that point, right? Most of my family didn't want to deal with me. I no longer could hang out with my nephews, which I loved, right? I could no longer take them to the park or to the movies by myself like I used to.
His parents would have brought down the moon for their child. But his parents in so many ways were unable to help. Parents couldn't speak English or read or write in terms of the medical charts and understanding. His dad, unfortunately, was battling cancer at the time, and his dad passed away during really the height of Ricky's illness. And so his mom was full-time caregiving for the dad. And so he kind of bounced around from different siblings' houses, but everyone sort of had their limit of ability to deal with that in their own home. And I was the constant. I had no limit for that. August 2012, I was sitting in 5 West A, Harborview's psychiatric unit. It was Ricky's fourth stay there. And it was his discharge planning meeting, and this relatively young psychiatrist is looking at Ricky, and he says to him, you're 25 years old and you're dying of your addiction. If we were in another state and I could commit you involuntarily to addiction treatment, I would. But my hands are tied under Washington state law. And my heart just shattered on the linoleum floor of that hospital room. He told me my loved one had the wrong disease. If he had a mental disorder, he could be saved. But because he had a different brain disease of addiction, he was going to be discharged to die. And that was a wholly unacceptable answer, not just for my Ricky, but for anybody's loved one, for anybody's child, for anybody's sibling, for, you know, each of those people is somebody's everything. At the time, the only option that families and loved ones had in the state was to try to have a loved one involuntarily committed via the mental health system.
I remember Lauren would constantly tell me, like, when we're at the ER, to just tell them you're suicidal, so they won't let you go. Even though those times I wasn't really suicidal, I mean, I just had to say that so I could get some sort of help, like an inpatient bed at the psych unit, so I could at least be safe for 7 to 14 days.
When he would end up in the psychiatric hospital, he would detox, and then he would have some clarity. He would start to feel like a person again, and his family and I would surround him with love, and he would start to have some hope again. And eventually, after one of those incidents, he chose to go to addiction treatment voluntarily.
And I refused to die, and I refused to let this addiction take over completely. This is it. And that was August 27, 2012. The biggest challenge was, of course, learning to live with all these emotions that you'd never really had to deal with. I had to learn how to reconnect with my family. I had to learn how to, you know, tell the truth, right? Because I was just so very used to lying all the time to get what I wanted. I remember telling Lauren one day that I wanted to do something that was meaningful, that was uber impactful, that I wanted to be a part of something that was gonna change and help others and help their journey and ease their path to recovery. And what better place to make change than Olympia, right?
After Ricky entered long-term recovery, I started schooling myself on the behavioral health system. I had to learn both the mental health and addiction treatment systems simultaneously, and eventually I was able to specifically identify what was the problem in state statute that didn't allow an adult or child to be involuntarily committed for addiction. And once I had that identified, I went to work and I started talking to lawmakers, and that was, but now we're in the summer of 2014, and that was really the birthplace of what became Ricky's Law.
I think this law is going to be a piece of legislation that's going to be that thing that's going to almost say no for you when you can't say no for yourself, right? Like in my case, Lauren was my hope. She was my armor bearer. She was my person who led me through, one that never gave up on me, even though a lot of the times I wanted to.
Ricky's Law went into effect in April of 2018. It allows for the involuntary commitment of a loved one who is suffering from addiction. The hope is for people to get sober enough to make a decision about entering a treatment program. Lauren Davis has been spending a lot more time in Olympia. In November of 2018, Lauren was elected to represent Washington's 32nd legislative district in the State House. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today the theme of the show is My Other Family. Rita Zawaida comes from a very large Roman Catholic family in Jordan. Today she lives in North Seattle. She wears a few different hats. She runs a tour company that takes people to places like Iran, Sudan, Azerbaijan, where people can both see sights and do aid work. Rita founded the Arab American Community Coalition of Washington State, and she runs an organization called Salam Cultural Museum. There's no actual museum yet. That's a goal. The organization aims to create a better understanding of Arab Americans. Sound Effect's Jennifer Wing visited Rita in her North End office, a block off of Highway 99. This is where staffers book plane tickets for clients, and supplies for Syrian refugees pile up in almost every room.
Hey, Omi. Rita has a small dog with a big personality. His name is Omar Sharif, after the famous Egyptian actor. And Omar tags along with us as Rita and I peer into the various boxes filling the main walkways in the office and taking up space in closets.
These are items that we get from people all across the U.S. Snow gloves to underwear to crew socks that are coming through.
And underneath us is a four-car garage that is almost at capacity with coats, diapers, shoes, you name it. All of this will be sent to a distribution center in Jordan.
Every 2 months, we have a 40-foot container that leaves from Seattle.
Rita's office is also filled with photographs. One of them is of Rita when she was a small girl, about 4 years old.
It's my Jordanian family right there. We are Bedouin Jordanian, a Christian tribe, one of the seven major tribes of Jordan. We are called the Ozezat, and I'm in the picture with my mother, father, and my grandparents.
Rita's parents decided to move to the United States in 1956 with the hope of giving their children a better education. They eventually ended up settling down in Seattle. And life here was pretty good. But then, at the age of 42, Rita's father died of a heart attack. Her mom thought about moving back to Jordan, but decided to stay in the Northwest. Her focus was on launching her now three children, and for Rita, who was 16, this meant finding a nice Jordanian husband.
I had a guy from Jordan that came, and she was trying to get me married to him, and I decided that it was the first time that she was allowing me out on dates, so I thought, oh, great, I get to go on a date, da-da-da-da. And I was 16 at the time, but I didn't realize that it was marriage, and I thought, whoa, when his sister came in with wedding rings and the whole bit.
Rita said no to this arranged match and eventually met her future husband in a picket line in the 1970s.
We were demonstrating for the Palestinian issue.
The man she was in love with was born to a Jewish mother and a Muslim father. Word of this relationship traveled fast in Seattle's small Middle Eastern Christian community. And for her Roman Catholic family, this union was not okay.
I was disowned by the family, totally, for marrying outside of the religion was just not acceptable. If anyone asked about me to my family, I was a person that didn't exist. I just, you know, you asked, oh, I met Rita. Who's that? We don't know her. I just didn't think that anything would happen like this, you know? I was sort of in a different world.
How did you deal with that?
I didn't live here, so it didn't matter to me.
Rita and her husband left. They built a new life in Aleppo, Syria.
And his family was great because they had seen what they had happened to his mother and dad.
You see, his parents, they also had a mixed marriage and were also shunned by the family.
His father was Muslim, the mother was Jewish, and they had done the same thing to them when they got married. And they felt that they were to blame for the parents dying. So when we got into the picture, they didn't want the same thing to happen.
7 years passed by. They had a daughter, and there was still no contact with Rita's family. Then one day, the Catholic nuns from her tribe in Jordan arrived, 40 of them, on a bus, headed to a convent in Turkey, but making this stop in Aleppo to check on their Rita, a small boy who had hopped on board the bus at the entrance of Aleppo to give directions for the nuns, got off of the bus first.
The little kid jumps out of the bus. And he goes like, the rahbis are here, the rahbis are here, which means the nuns are here, the nuns are here, right? So I tell them to open the gate and let these guys in. So they start coming in one by one. And what's hilarious is that if you see, you know, Roman Catholic nuns, right? they're all wearing the black habit, right, and the little white, okay. So what do the Muslim women wear? The black, right, scarves. They all look the same. They all looked exactly the same.
The nuns wanted to make sure that Rita was okay. They wanted to know if her daughter was baptized, and they wanted to talk to Rita's husband.
We want to see your husband. I says, he doesn't want to see you. He's scared. And they will not leave. They will not leave until he comes back home. That's it. He will not. And finally, I says, look, I came halfway around this world, and I'm here with you. So you got to be able to get here. They're not going to do anything to you. They're nuns. So he ended up finally coming. He has red hair and freckles. He looks like he is, belongs like a crusader, or he's Irish or something, totally not looking Syrian. And he's able to win him over. And yes, I could, if you know, I would do this if you want, and I will do this if you want. It was the talk for quite a while.
Hearing Rita's story and how her family shut her out, I ask her again about the old family photo that was taken in Jordan with her parents and grandparents before the move to the U.S., and what this photo means to her today. The question brings her to tears.
I think it just means family. Family's everything. That's all I can say.
How did you, so you have it, you have that photo up, even though
this owned you, they're still family.
Even though they disowned you, yeah. Still family.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
What happened to your relationship with your mom?
Oh, she's passed away.
Did you ever get on the same page?
Yeah. Not really. No. Oh, that would have... was never resolved at all. You know, it was like... You ended up marrying wrong. You ended up getting divorced. You did everything wrong at some point.
Even though Rita was not able to repair things with her mom, she is very close to her two brothers who also live in the States. Rita came back to this country decades ago, fleeing civil war in Syria. She and her husband did end up getting divorced. Her ex-husband's family is now scattered. Many are still stuck in Syria. She talks to them every week. And to her, they are still very much family.
That story from Sound Effects' Jennifer Wing. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme today is My Other Family. For a lot of LGBTQ people, it's still the case that coming out means giving up connections to family. And so chosen family becomes hugely important. Matthias Roberts is a mental health counselor in Seattle, and he hosts a podcast called Queerology. It's focused on queer people of faith. Matthias grew up in a conservative evangelical setting where homosexuality was considered a sin.
We moved to Iowa when I was 10, and that's when I kind of started realizing that I was gay. I always knew there was something different about me, but that was when, you know, puberty was starting, and realized, wait a second, like, I'm attracted to men in the same way that these guys in my Boy Scout group seem to be attracted to women, and what's going on?
How did you think about the eventual prospect of telling your parents?
I kind of vowed that I would never tell my parents. Didn't think that they would ever find out. I didn't plan to ever talk about it to anyone. It was going to be kind of like my little secret, because I thought, I mean, and I believed that I could change my sexual orientation, that this would be just a phase, or that, you know, something was wrong with me, and if I prayed enough, or, like, you know, made enough promises to God that if I were to go be a missionary or whatever, then my sexual orientation would change and I'd get married to a woman and no one would be any wiser. But that's not what happened.
When did you first broach it with your parents?
So when I was 15, I was working at a small public library in the town that we lived in. And there was this fitness section that I would, when I'd be shelving books, I would sit in that section and like flip through. And it was like the only place that I could find like shirtless pictures of men in this section in the library. And I brought one of the books home with me. And had hid it under my bed. And my mom, when she was cleaning my room one day, found it. And I think things clicked for her. She called me downstairs and asked me, she's like, do you have this book because you're interested in getting fit? Or is it because you like the pictures? And I answered her honestly. I had it because of the pictures. Like, it was a 80s homoerotic guys for fitness book. Like, it wasn't it's full page spreads of men wearing next to nothing. Like, it was pretty obvious why I had the book. And I saw my mom's face just fall, but she also gave me a huge hug and said, we'll work through this together. Like, I don't know what to do, but we'll work through this together. I mean, they didn't know what they were working with. Like, they were just as lost as I was, but at the time I felt cared for.
So how did that evolve over the next bunch of years?
We never talked about it much. Like, it was always this kind of hushed thing in secret, like kept away from my sisters. My dad and I would meet at like 6:30 in the morning at a coffee shop to talk about my attractions and read scriptures together. And that kind of shroud of secrecy remained up until I started coming out to my sisters, which was, I mean, it was in my early 20s when that happened. And I had thought my parents would evolve along with me. I kind of kept them in the loop, being like, here's what I'm learning. Here are what other people are saying. Did you know there are other people out there who believe they can be gay and Christian? Like, I kept them in the loop on that until I started realizing pretty quickly I was hitting a line. And then past that line, and my parents started telling me, you're starting to believe lies. Like, this isn't true. You're being deceived. And that distance started developing between me and my parents. But what started happening, it meant that I wasn't as forthcoming with my parents about my life. Things that I wanted to share with them, but didn't feel like I could because their/our belief system prevented that. Like, I've had to grieve a loss of my parents because they aren't involved in my life. They don't really know me.
So where are you at the moment in terms of your relationship with your folks?
It's still evolving, and it's tense. My parents have been very explicit within the last year about what they will and won't accept in my life. And I am still currently trying to figure out what to do with that.
What are those lines that they've drawn?
I mean, they've told me that if I ever get into, I'm currently single right now. My parents have said, if I ever get into a relationship, a serious relationship, then I can no longer be a part of the family.
What was that like to hear?
It was devastating. There were words that I never thought I would hear from my dad's mouth.
Because it had been a while at this point, more than 10 years.
Yeah, I'd been out to them for 11 years.
And have you thought about how you might handle it if that happens? I mean, if you find yourself in a relationship?
Yeah, I have. I mean, it's a relationship is something that I deeply want and am actively pursuing. My hope is that my parents will shift. Like, if that happens, when I get into a relationship, like, and it's serious enough that I'm ready for this person to meet my parents, I would hope that that line will stare them in the face and they'll be able to see what they're losing.
As you have gotten to know other LGBTQ folks, mm-hmm. what have you learned about how unique or how common your experience with your family is?
Yeah, it's incredibly common. And in fact, my experience has been pretty easy compared to most people, or maybe not most, to a lot of people. A lot of people have had their families just completely disown them, especially people in faith communities. And so queer people have to find other ways to get that emotional fulfillment that families are supposed to be bringing.
How did that work for you? How did you start to, I don't know, fill in some of those spaces that were left by that broken relationship?
In Arkansas, I actually started going to this little tiny yoga studio that was run by the wife to one of the Episcopalian priests in town. And they, Lori and Stan, pretty quickly became parental figures in my life. I started going over to their house for dinner. I started going to their church and found another way of doing life where I didn't have to hide any of myself from them. I don't think I had ever had adult figures in my life that I wasn't afraid of how they would respond if they found out that I was gay, because that was my entire world growing up. Love was almost conditional, and they showed me an unconditional love that profoundly transformed me.
So you said that your experience is not uncommon among gay and lesbian people. Have you found that these surrogate families, these, I don't know if that's a fair way to say it, but, you know, these chosen families and chosen parent figures are a big part of the culture of, like, gay life?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, chosen family is not an uncommon term in the queer community. It's a given, pretty much, that we all have our families of people that we know have our back, and we need them in order to survive.
Matthias Roberts is a licensed mental health counseling associate and host of the podcast Queerology. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is Sound Effect, telling stories today about my other family. For nearly 20 years, Gulshan Yunus ran a daycare in her Mount Lake Terrace home. As you might expect, she made a lot of chicken nuggets, built quite a few blanket forts, and played endless hours of kid shows and the occasional Pakistani soap opera. But Gulshan was always more than a daycare worker to the kids in her house, and the kids were more than just charges to her.
They are like children to me, you know.
Yeah, that's all they call you, mommy.
Yeah, they all call me, I mean mother.
Yeah.
That's Marisa Como Karaji. She was one of the kids Gulshan took care of. She's all grown up now, and she still spends time with Ami. The location, though, is a little different. Marisa took us there.
When I was growing up, both my parents worked full-time, so they needed someone to take care of me during the day. So, like most parents, they tried really hard to find the right person. But in the end, and this is kind of a family joke now, I picked Gulshan.
No, my mom and dad always said I picked you.
So the day they met up with her, I kept crying and crying.
And no one could calm me down, and then...
And Gulshan just looked over and said, give her to me. And the second I landed in her arms, I was silent.
And they're like, yep, that's how she picked you. She picked it.
The same thing happened with Elizabeth, you know?
Yeah?
Yeah, her mom said, when you pick her up, I said, this is the one I want.
So Gulshan took care of me almost every weekday, starting from when I was baby to about 4. She also took care of my good friend Elizabeth and at least a dozen other kids. She also had her own family, too. I remember her house being constantly filled with people coming in and out to eat, grab their stuff, or just to come in and say hi.
And I did for 18 years. And then those kids grown up, so then I stopped.
The daycare kids grew up, her own 3 kids grew up, and 10 years ago, her husband, Papa Yunus, passed away. After so many years with a full house, suddenly Gulshan was alone, and she needed something else to do. So she started taking walks. She tried walking around her neighborhood, but she didn't always feel that safe, and it's no fun in the rain. So her oldest son bought her a gym membership, but all she did there was walk.
So then I said, why I have to waste my money on the walk? I can be a walk free here, you know?
And then she found the mall. A safe, warm place where she could walk in peace.
Hello.
Without paying a membership
fee.
How are
you? Good, good, thank you.
I've been away from Seattle for a while, and I recently moved back. And so I called Gulshan to hang out, and she said, well, come to the mall with me. Okay. So the first time I went with her was a little awkward. She started introducing me to people she knew by saying, "Oh, this is my daughter Marisa. She's not married." But things got a little more comfortable after that. So now when I go with her, we have a routine.
I do after 2:30, because you know, our prayer is I pray that and then I come, usually.
We walk into the mall through the same door, we walk in the same direction, and we make the same number of loops.
From JCPenney to JCPenney 1, so I do 5. 3 to this side and 2-3 in food court. So I do that.
She never buys anything.
Because I don't wear those clothes or anything, you know, just I want some perfume that my kids give me on my birthday, so I don't need anything.
She does stop to say hello to all the people that work at the kiosks. Derek, from the calendar stand, has seen Gulshan a lot.
She's a really nice mall lady. I call her a mall lady, but she walks the mall every day. And she always stops by to give me a nice candy or gum.
Then there's Zanet from Kazakhstan, who sells splat balls.
Splat balls, squishies, small kiosks.
I love and hate these things at the same time. They're like super addicting little water-filled fidgets that you can squeeze and throw. Gulshan says hi to Zanet a lot.
She always, every day, walking around and giving to everybody candies. That's how I know, like, real Santa Claus.
And then there are the cell phone guys. She gives everyone else hard candy from her purse, but for these guys, she gives them a box of homemade sweets. The guys are from Pakistan and India, and they have a special bond with Gulshan. I call Gulshan Ami, or mother, but they have a special name for her too.
She's Auntie Gulshan. She's a sweetheart to everyone.
Cell phone guys are always Gulshan's first stop when she gets to the mall.
I feel so happy with her because I can discuss a lot of things with her, especially the girls talk.
They hold her coat for her at their stand while she walks, so she can walk hands-free.
So, she's a sweetheart.
Her last lap always lands her back to their stand so she can pick up her coat. And then she walks through JCPenney and back out to her car. Then we drive to her house. We always end our time together by drinking chai in her living room. It still smells the same. A few things have changed here and there, and it's emptier now, but it's still the same house I grew up in. When I was a kid, it was normal for us to see Gulshan surrounded by people in this house. It was just the way things were. But now when I see her holding her chai and talking to me, it's kind of like being friends with your parents. I'm not seeing her as a mom or some authority figure. I see her as Gulshan, the social person who can go to the mall and make friends with total strangers. It explains how all these people ended up at her house in the first place. She's just that person everybody wants as a friend, or an ami, or an auntie. And I think she really enjoys being the kind of person that can be friends with a guy reading a book at a calendar stand, or some kids trying to get their green cards working at a cell phone kiosk. And I know she really enjoys that her daycare kids love her enough to keep coming back.
It's really good, you know, that they, mostly people don't remember. They just forget everything, but those kids still remember me. It is a big thing for me.
I'm Marisa Komokerji, and my ami, Gulshan, is my other family.
Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestad, Jennifer Wing, and Posey Gruner. Thanks this week to Marisa Komokerji, Nina Shapiro, Mike Lewis, Aaron Hennessy, and Kari Ploeg. Our executive producer is Florangela Davila. We hope you'll take a moment to subscribe to our free podcast, which is available in all the podcast places. And if you have feedback on the show or suggestions for stories to cover, send them to soundeffect@knkx.org or find us on Facebook. We're back next week when our theme is The Past is Still With Us. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is KNKX.